All right, welcome back to the podcast. Great to have you. Hope you're enjoying our regular rotation once again as the preseason's well underway and we are ever so closer to the season starting. Today we bring back on ESPN's Jay Billis, who's always so kind to come on a couple times during the season. Jay, thanks for coming on, man. How are you doing? And are you ready for the season to start or what?
I am ready. Anytime it gets cold, Matt, I'm ready to go. Hope you're doing well. And I'm looking forward to this year. I think it's going to be a good year, and we've got some good teams to start off, and somebody will come out of nowhere. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Now, do you get to go to a lot of schools, September, October, as you prepare for the season ahead, or are you busy doing other things in your day-to-day?
It's a little bit of both. I do go around. I don't go as much as I used to. I used to go to, 15, 20 practices all around the country. I try to limit that because I travel so much. So I stick a little bit. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, so it's easy for me to get to a number of places by car. But by the time I get to November, I will be all over the place and will have seen so many teams that going to practices now, like I used to, isn't of the same value to me. So I try to be judicious about the travel I put out there.
You doing Maui again this year?
Yeah, I'll be in Maui. I start off actually in Germany.
Oh, you're going?
On November 9th, I'm doing that with Dan Schulman, doing the it's Michigan State UConn in Germany. Then I come back and we do a preview show up in Connecticut, a game day preview, and then I go down to the Champions Classic in Atlanta for Kansas, Michigan State.
Now, did you lobby for the Germany trip, or did they just give it to you? I mean, that's pretty awesome, man. I'm very interested to see how that comes off on TV and what the site actually looks like.
Me too. I did the game last year with Dan Schulman and Dick Vitale on the carrier, the USS Carl Vinson in San Diego. And I've been a couple times over to the Middle East with Operation Hardwood with Tom Izzo both times that I went. So I've had a little bit of a history with this the military in this, and so I was honored to be invited to do it again.
That's pretty fantastic. Hey, real quick, what do you think about the fact that we've got three aircraft carrier games? I mean, I'll probably end up writing on this as we get closer to it. I mean, I guess on one hand it's cool, but on the other hand, I kind of wish there was only one. Kind of one every year, almost like the Winter Classic in hockey. They only do the one outdoor game on January 1st or whatever. Are we? I know it's only in year two, but do you think there might be a chance there's a bit of overkill here, and it could be saturating the market, so to speak? Or am I a little off on that?
Well, I think it depends on what we're talking about. I think from a TV standpoint and all that, you can sort of overdo it. Because it was so incredibly cool last year when the President of the United States on deck and when Air Force One banked in right around the ship, it was awesome. And the setting, having North Carolina and Michigan State play, was tremendous. I think it'll be tremendous this time, too. There are, I think, three games at least on aircraft carriers and not including the game at Ramstein. For me, the best part of it is for the troops that they get to see up close a game, the focus. I tend to think that the United States military is the best team in the world. And for them to have college teams playing before them like that, honoring the troops, I think it's all good. But just from a business standpoint, if you say, hey, is this game going to be the same? Are these games going to be the same as last year? Maybe not. Maybe they won't be. I don't know. But if it were only for doing this to honor, our men and women in uniform, then I think it's absolutely a great thing.
Totally. Absolutely. Can you just real quick set the scene what it was like a year ago before the game started? Like, did they have the military file in as, the hour or two leading up to the game? I mean, everyone saw the anthem on TV and all that, but the stuff that didn't make TV that still stands out to you a year removed, is there anything that you can kind of depict for us?
Yeah, it was the most well-behaved crowd in the history of sports, perhaps. Everybody was in their seats well over an hour before the game, and there was very little crowd movement. It wasn't like a normal game where people come in, mill around. There wasn't a whole lot of that. We were on board hours before the game, the timing of it didn't go off, I think, as everybody had planned. The president met with the teams beforehand, and because of that meeting and the length of it, it delayed warm-ups, and both coaches wanted a full warm-up, so it delayed the start of the game. But the things that everybody worried about, would the weather hold up? It was in San Diego, right near Coronado, and there was no mist. The court wasn't slick. There was some concerns about that, whether it would rain, and the game would have to be played below deck with maybe a less than a third of the crowd being able to be there, even less than that probably. But they decided the night before to play it on deck. It was an absolutely gorgeous evening. So when the sun went down, the sky was orange. The wind was minimal, so it wasn't, you know, it didn't make for playing outdoors. Doesn't make for the best basketball. That's why, if I remember right, Syracuse is playing San Diego State out in San Diego on an aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. You know, you put a premium on perimeter shooting against the 2-3 zone. It's going to be even easier, I think, for Jim Boeheim to stay in that zone and dare somebody to shoot over it. But it was an absolutely awe-inspiring experience to be there. And to see how the players interacted with the troops, what a good time I think everybody involved had, and you know, it was Veterans Day. It just gave a great feeling of national pride. And then after the game, I don't know whether this was talked about beforehand, but the players, both North Carolina and Michigan State, wore uniforms that were camouflage in sort of with their colors. And the players, I think it was led by Michigan State's Draymond Green, if I remember right, they took their uniforms off and they gave them to the troops. And that was about as cool a thing as I've seen. It was really a heartwarming thing, and it brought a lot of pride, I think. And I don't think any of the players, coaches, broadcasters, anybody involved will ever forget it.
Yeah, that was fantastic. And actually, that whole uniform giving thing, I hope, you know, we see more of that this year. I think there was one uniform that ended up on eBay and it caused a little bit of a stir. Hopefully we dodge that next month. All right, let's talk about some contemporary stories here in college hoops. I want to first go to Kentucky because it's just good podcasting to get Kentucky near the top of the podcast. People tend to hang around. And they've got this all-access thing on ESPN. It's been awesome. As a college hoops fan, I just eat this stuff up. I'll take anything I can get in that regard, even, you know, knowing Calipari and having seen these players a little bit, just to see, you know, get inside the practice facility, get inside his office. It's cool. But a couple things. One, today as we're recording this on Thursday afternoon, and it's SEC Media Day, even though the podcast is going live on Friday. So Billy Donovan and all the SEC coaches were there. It was kind of inevitable that guys were going to get asked about the Kentucky All-Access thing. I mean, clearly it's a fantastic opportunity for UK to further build its empire, certainly from a PR and image standpoint. And so Donovan was a little down on the process. He didn't fault Kentucky or Calipari for doing it. But he said, if you're using it as a recruiting tool, I don't think that's right. So, Jay, my question for you is, it enters into an interesting conversation for Kentucky and for the NCAA, because this is essentially, I think there are three episodes, so it's 90 minutes of free advertising that ESPN is affording Kentucky, the school that above any doesn't need it, but also the coach that's better than anyone at doing this. So is the NCAA in a philosophical quandary here in that it probably can't stop Kentucky from doing this? It's Kentucky's right and probably ESPN's right to do this, but at the same time, there has to be some sort of tangible recruiting advantage that UK is getting that other schools can't afford. And I'm not even talking about small guys. I'm just talking about, like, UCLA doesn't have this opportunity. Florida might not have this opportunity because obviously ESPN's only going to dedicate its prime programming to doing this with one specific big-time college basketball team in a given season.
Yeah, those are all good questions. I tend to think, you know, kind of what the issue is, you know, sort of the NCAA's ubiquitous, at least discussed, level playing field. And to me, Matt, the only level playing field we need to worry about is the court itself. That's the only playing field that needs to be level. If you look at it, exposure is available to everyone based upon the market. And, you know, Duke had a practice at Fort Bragg, and ESPNU put it on television. Is that an advantage? Well, it is an advantage, but it's not unfair. And that's really the issue, because I've done all access pieces for years. In fact, I think those were the first ones that went on ESPN, if I remember right.
Right, when the SportsCenter 4 or 5 minute bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then they packaged them and put them into shows and put them on at different times, the longer versions and on the internet and all that stuff. So, you know, not surprisingly, all those All Access pieces were the top programs, top rated programs, and that would get the most eyeballs. And there were times when I would say, hey, why don't we go here? Because this team's going to be one of the best teams this year. And the answer you'd get from the TV side is, well, this other one would rate better. You'd get more attention with this one. That's just the nature of the business and the nature of television. I have no problem with any of that stuff. You know, I'm in the television business. You are too, in the media business, and that's the way it goes. The issue to me is it unfair? And it's not unfair. You know, I've done All Access pieces with Billy Donovan, and I don't think he's wrong in saying, hey, you know, we have to look at it. But the question I have is, what do we do? Because right now, Matt, you see this as much, if not more, than I do. I mean, Oklahoma is live streaming their practices. You know, we're going to have more access to this, to these games than we've ever had. Behind-the-scenes stuff, all-access stuff. The programs can do it on their own. They've got their own websites that that have all-access pieces that they're putting together. So, and with NBC, CBS, all these different outlets that are competing, ESPN, we're going to see more of this, not less. So I think the unfair advantage cry, to me, at least they fall upon my deaf ears. I don't really think it's that big of a deal because it is available to everybody. And Kentucky gets a lot of press. When a top recruit commits, you know, we put it on television. And oftentimes it's going to Kentucky, UCLA, Duke, North Carolina, all those places. And the mid-majors don't get that kind of exposure. And people can say, well, that's unfair. That's not a level. Well, right. Well, what are we going to do? We're going to not put any of this on television? This is, I think the problem we have, Matt, is that we're trying to say this is amateur and everybody should be the same when it's a professional enterprise. This is a pro enterprise. It's a multi-billion dollar business.
Totally. And yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's a hard, but that's where your question, I'm sorry to interrupt. That's where your question comes about, you know, does this bump up on the philosophy that the NCAA has? And the answer is it does, but there's nothing anybody can do about it because they do it too. You know, they put out sort of their own propaganda, if you will, or all access or all that stuff. They put out their own stories all the time too. And we're essentially part, you know, CBS that you work for, ESPN that I work for, we're all partners with the NCAA in that. So I don't know that there's anything they can do about it. And honestly, I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I'd like to see some more all access and have all access NCAA and, you know, let us inside what they do every day and follow their people around. I think that'd be a heck of an interesting project.
I agree. I think Donovan's point is with your pieces in the past, they were either for the internet, 8-minute pieces. If they were on SportsCenter, they were 3 or 4 minute pieces that were primarily you talking to coaches after practice and getting shots of coaches, you know, talking to their guys in practice. Whereas the Kentucky thing now is a whole new ball game in that it's ESPN at, you know, 7 o'clock every Wednesday or whatever it is. And it's not just practice shots. It's kids actually talking to the camera in a reality format. You've got, I think it was Poitras, Cauley Stein that was basically saying, you know, I was debating on where to go to, and then I saw Kentucky could do this, and Cal's going to Final Fours, and this is why I'm going to Kentucky. So it's got a little bit of this pitch feel. I think that's where Donovan's coming from, not that it's wrong or that it's right. I think he's saying there's a distinction between what used to be done and now what Kentucky is doing. I'm with you. I don't have any problem with it being done. I just think it's a fair conversation to have. And, yes, it's just the reason why I bring it up in general is because it leads itself to this quandary the NCAA is in that it's never going to get out of, and that it simply just refuses to look into the mirror and accept the fact that college sports is a professional enterprise, and it's clinging to its decades-old ideals as much as it can. But with each passing year, whether it's this Kentucky thing or you pick any sort of instance, whether it's a story about a kid with his face on a poster for a party or whatever it is, like there's going to be something every month that's just going to further and further prove what the NCAA is actually doing, whether it wants to be privy to it or not. It just keeps happening. And I guess with all of this, we just kind of wait for that turning point, that acknowledgement. And I think it's going to happen. But, Jay, I mean, are we 5, 10? Are we still 20 years away from some sort of real – I'm talking legitimate acknowledgement, you know, on paper, this is what we are. We are no longer what we were that said we were in the 20s, the 50s, the 80s. When is that change going to come?
It's going to be a while. I think it's going to take a little bit longer for everybody to wrap their heads around the fact that the players are assets of the university. And I think the first place that you're going to see it really bump up against that that sort of philosophical problem that the NCAA has, number of philosophical problems, is in the transfer rules. You know, as you know, there are four different working groups that Mark Emmert has essentially commissioned to go through a lot of different issues that are facing college sports right now. One of them is on the rule book. They're trying to take the rule book down from 450 pages or whatever it is, this gigantic thing that no reasonable person would want to live under, let alone if they could lift it without help. And they're probably going to cut it in half, which is still too big. But one of the things I was reading about some of the things they've been doing thus far is with regard to the transfer rule. And, you know, the transfer rules, as you know, are all over the place. It's really a mess, where some guys are eligible year to year. It's different in different sports, and then others have to sit out. But the problem you have is if you say, okay, everybody has to sit out, and this is for competitive balance reasons, if a player leaves to go to another school, you're acknowledging that the players are assets, that business decisions have been made with as far as their recruiting and their place on a roster, and if they leave, it has significant consequences on your roster. But the NCAA is sticking with this idea that players are students who just happen to be athletes, and they're to be treated like any other student. Okay, well, if you go that way, no other student has to sit out, and they can take aid somewhere else. It's not treated that way. And honestly, Matt, I think they're probably going to wind up going that way because of their philosophy on this. And I think it's the right thing for that philosophy, that a kid should be able to go anytime he wants and accept aid somewhere else, and shouldn't be treated differently than any other student. But they also shouldn't be restricted from being compensated. Like, there are no other student, no other person in a university community is restricted from taking compensation outside of school, even within the school. So they're going to bump up against that problem, and it's going to be a constant issue until they allow the players to A, be compensated, and B, to have to have freedom of movement like any other student, and to be treated like any other student. And that's a real quandary that they're in, and I don't think they're going to be able to get out of it with the way they currently look at things.
I did not see an opinion of yours yet, and if you offered it, apologies for missing it, on the Shabazz Muhammad situation at UCLA. It is becoming the predominant preseason college basketball story. One, he apparently hurt his shoulder, and we're waiting for the results of that MRI. They could come as we're recording this podcast, and we'll see the extent of that damage and what it means in terms of him actually being able to play. If it's a 2, 6, 8 week thing, we don't know yet. So let's just toss that aside and just talk about his eligibility. How much have you read and know about his state of limbo with UCLA, and do you have an opinion on what punishment would be fair, or should it come at all from him?
Well, that's a good question. I think it goes, you know, if you're going strictly by the NCAA's rules and amateurism and all that, you know, his knowing a financial advisor and whether he took, quote-unquote, took extra benefits, that's something that I don't think anybody outside of the NCAA really knows the answer to right now. At least I don't. So it depends on what the facts are there as to how the NCAA is going to handle it. My own personal opinion, I think the NCAA goes about this the wrong way. I don't think they should be in the eligibility business. I don't think what a kid takes prior to coming to school is any of the NCAA's business. I think the only business they should have is, you know, if they're dealing with amateurs, is the kid a pro or not? And, because you've got players all over the place that are ineligible according to the rules, and the NCAA just doesn't know about it or can't figure it out. And I think it'd be folly to think otherwise. So I don't like the way, you know, sort of you have people that are singled out here and, you know, sort of it's the good player program. Everybody looks at the good players to find out what's going on. It goes back to the fundamental principle that these players have value. And to deny that and pretend that they're all amateur and in a multi-billion-dollar business is absurd. And it gets us into all kinds of problems. You know, the only thing really, Matt, that's amateur in the United States is amateur golf. And the stark difference between those two things is amazing. One amateur golfers decide whether they're going to play, when they're going to play, if they're going to play. And they determine on their own whether they're going to practice. You know, and amateur golf doesn't make any money. There's no money in amateur golf. There's billions involved in college sports. And we pretend that these players are amateur, and it's wrong. The way we're going about this is wrong. There's no reason to deny them the value that they create and that they have, especially when we allow it with regard to athletes in different sports. You have professional baseball players playing college football, and then we have a problem. You know, you have a millionaire playing college football because he's made over $1 million in professional baseball. And yet we're worried about whether Shahbaz Muhammad took some extra benefits when he was in high school. The whole thing doesn't make a whole lot of logical sense. And I think it punishes the wrong people, which are the kids and the ones that have value and are creating great value.
Yeah, and I could splinter off into about 12 different areas from what you talked about there. But I want to specifically go to something that I posted on the site Thursday. It relates to a piece in The Atlantic written by a lawyer named Stephen A. Miller, who lives in Philadelphia, apparently has some Kentucky ties. Someone tweeted at me that he had Kentucky ties. I didn't realize that. But anyway,
So do I. I have Kentucky ties. My nephew, Stephen Billis, is the student body president of Kentucky right now.
Well, how about that? Okay.
How about that? And how about this? As student body president, he's paid.
Exactly. Oh,
it's amazing.
Totally. Yeah.
He's on full scholarship. He's on full academic scholarship, and as student body president, the University of Kentucky pays him. I think they pay him $5,000 a year, if I'm not mistaken. And he mentioned to me in a text message when he was elected that they just calculated the hours they expected him to spend as student body president and applied the minimum wage to it. So he gets paid by the university, but Anthony Davis didn't. I thought that was kind of funny.
Some sort of concept there. the Atlantic argues basically that the NCAA's ways of punishing and investigating schools is inconsistent. It can be compromised due to the natural relationship of big schools bringing in big money, which the NCAA needs, and basically says it should outsource all major violations. It should hire – it says the investigators don't have investigative backgrounds. These are people often that come and were once tennis players in school or did whatever, and then they're put on the task force. And it says, listen, the staff isn't totally qualified. It's understaffed. You could use so many more people, and it's only centralized in Indianapolis. Why not have bureaus, so to speak? And basically says it should outsource all major violations. The secondary stuff the NCAA can still deal with because that's tiny. And really, it kind of just it's almost filler. It's just too much to even keep up with. So do you agree with Miller's point? And I steadfastly did and kind of opined a little too long on the site about it, that the NCAA should look into. I don't know if it'll ever do it, but it should look into hiring legitimate investigators and having them all over the country look into, actually investigate, and be the ones that determine punishment so we can have more consistency for the rules that are broken that are worth punishing in the future.
The short answer is yes, I agree, and I've been advocating that for years. And all you have to do is look toward the United States Olympic Committee. You know, the USOC has all their disputes arbitrated by the American Arbitration Association, the AAA, which handles – I've appeared before the AAA as a lawyer in a lot of complex cases years ago when I was litigating full-time. And that's – I think that's the route the NCAA should go, that when you have an organization that is like the NCAA, rules maker, investigator, sort of policeman, judge, jury, and executioner all in one – the results are untrustworthy. And I think what you wind up having is a system that is adversarial, but at the same time, you've got parties that are at odds with each other. In other words, you may have a coach and other administrators that are named individually, and the school is put in the position of having to protect itself by compromising the rights of the individuals and maybe cutting them loose to save themselves and to save the institution. And I think what you saw with Penn State, the fact that an independent investigator was brought in, conducted an investigation, and then that investigation was used, you know, the free report. I thought the NCAA made horrible mistakes with the way they handled that. But you know, an independent investigator can get to things a lot quicker, a lot easier, and with a lot more credibility than the schools can themselves or the NCAA can. And I think that Mr. Miller is exactly right with regard to NCAA investigators. They're not trained. They don't have any rules. You know, we're always worried about institutions and coaches and the like pushing the envelope with regard to rules and the spirit of the rules and gray area. Well, what's the spirit of the rules and what's the gray area with regard to investigations and pushing the envelope there? I mean, you've got investigators that are showing up on high school campuses unannounced and pulling kids out of class to interview them without the chance to talk with anyone and get advice and go through that. Nobody else has to do that in any other walk of life. That's not fair and it's not right. And you know, I think some people within the NCAA would admit that. But it's a bad system, and I think it's got to be fixed. And even people within the organization, there are some people that don't agree with the way they do it. There are many people within the NCAA structure, you know, that are at different schools, and people, lawyers who appear before the NCAA all the time, people on the Committee on Infractions, think there should be changes. So I tend to agree. I think having it outsourced to the AAA, it would be cheaper. Because the schools spend millions of dollars annually on outside counsel, and they don't need to do that. It's absurd the amount of money that's spent. It's absurd the amount of money that's spent on compliance, but that's a function of the rules themselves. But I do – long answer, but to get to a short answer is I agree with Mr. Miller. Those changes should be made.
And one more quick thing on the NCAA. I don't know if I've ever heard you talk about this, so real quick. You know, you're one of the most famous railers and ribbers of the NCAA, but is it better now than it was when you were in college in the mid-80s, or is it worse than 25 years ago?
It's both. I think it's better in that the game is administered better. When the NCAA stays within its lane, when they handle issues with regard to competition, they do a good job. When they get out of their lane and they start dealing with issues of eligibility and, you know, they get into all this academic eligibility stuff, they're out of their element and out of their lane. They can't police all this stuff. And I think you see the results of it. You know, we're dealing almost, it seems like almost weekly, with a quote-unquote scandal. That's not a scandal. You know, we throw the word scandal around. It's scandalous how much we use the word scandal, but it's ridiculous. You know, some of these things don't rise to the level of scandal, and it's silly how much time we spend on issues that don't relate to competition. You know, Matt, if we were manufacturing drugs and bringing them to market, or if we were dealing with medical devices, or if we were transporting heavy explosives, or you know, if we were dealing with plutonium or something, then I'd understand all this regulation. All we're doing is playing ball here. You know, these schools can handle the admission, you know, the identification of prospects, their admission, and their education. They can handle all that just fine. The NCAA doesn't need to be in that business. And what they need to do is deal with what they're good at, and that's administering championships. And let's make the level playing field the field itself, and the rest of it, whether it's Kentucky being on TV or whether Murray State gets the same amount of, you know, has the same amount of training meals as the University of North Carolina, I don't think anybody really cares about that stuff. Yeah. Or thinks that it should be that we can make all that equal. We can't, and trying to makes us all look like idiots, and we're just wasting our time and spinning our wheels. Things are not better. You know, things are not better now than they were years ago. They're just not. But they're not worse either. We pretend they are, and they're not worse either. We've had these problems since 1905, and we're not going to fix them by saying integrity. You know, one of the guys that was waving his finger around yelling integrity, integrity, integrity at the summit that Mark Emmert had well over a year ago was Graham Spanier. And presidents don't have integrity in greater measure than any other segment of society. That's been proven. And when they say that they're in charge, I don't feel any better, because there's a difference between being a leader and being in charge. And I think things ran a lot better when you had people with an athletic background running athletics instead of the president's this so-called in charge. And I think that's one of the problems we have now as well.
I want to wrap up with something Gina Wormiema said, and I appreciate, by the way, all the the thoughts on the. I don't bring you just on to go against the NCAA again, but these are kind of issues that I feel need to continually be discussed so we can evolve the discussion and maybe get some movement. I mean, this kind of change doesn't really happen unless it's in a conversation that's, if not daily, at least weekly, so the NCAA is aware. And
but Matt, that's a good point. And, I know it's easy for people to think I don't like the NCAA. I do. Their people are great. I love the people at the NCAA. They have great people. I do think they get into areas they don't belong in. But, it's funny. The things that we've talked about over the years and at times ridiculed because they deserved ridicule are a lot of the things that are being moved to change now. And I think they should be changing more. I think we'll get closer to that as we go forward. But unless we discuss this and debate it, I'm perfectly willing to hear the other side to everything I say. But it's odd how silent the NCAA is when you say it in large measure, because I think they know it's true. I think this is a value, and I commend you for doing it. It's a valuable debate to have, and people that disagree should say that they disagree and why, because it just I think it just elevates the debate.
Agreed. Now, last point here on the podcast. I'm fascinated with what Gino Auriemma is proposing for women's college basketball. We don't really get heavy on the women's hoops on the podcast naturally, but he is basically going to actually legitimately go to the NCAA and propose wholesale changes to the women's game. So to me, this actually got a quick bit on PTI. To me, it's actually worthy of some pretty heavy headlines here, because he wants a 24-second shot clock. He wants one site for the women's Final Four permanently, maybe two. He suggests San Antonio. He wants that Final Four to be he said Friday, Sunday instead of Sunday, Tuesday. But the big headline is lowering the rim in the women's game, because he argues, women's basketball from the mid-90s until about 02 or 03 was on a steady, steady climb. And since, 02 or 03, it's been going down, 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 down in terms of interest. He has valid points. I agree with some of them. I get why people wouldn't want to lower the rim. Of all those things, what stands out to you that the women's game most needs, least needs, and thoughts on Auriemma basically being the only guy that could actually propose this stuff and possibly get change to happen?
Well, I haven't heard the part about the Final Four being in one place. I think that would be great for not only the women's game, but I don't think it would be bad for the men's game either. One of the great places for any tournament is the Big East tournament, Madison Square Garden. They have it at the same place every year, and I don't think it's coincidence that has been the best tournament and has had the same look and the same feel. It's been fabulous. So I think that's a great idea and something I think that the NCAA should explore for both men's and women's basketball. The changes, all the marketing thoughts I think are good thoughts. That may be separate from the play on the court. The lowering of the rim I thought was a really interesting idea, and I thought the analogy to women's volleyball was a good one, because I think he's right that I have given very little thought to the fact that the net in women's volleyball is lower than it is for men's. And, my sister played volleyball years ago at UCLA, and women's volleyball is one of my favorite games.
It is ridiculously underrated how passionate it is.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
It's awesome. I covered it for a number of years. Very good.
And I've covered the women's basketball. I did it in 2000 at the Women's Final Four and covered the WNBA for a number of years. And I do think that the game would benefit by having the rims lowered. Probably the biggest issue that college would have would be the cost of that, if there would be a cost associated with it. You may have some that say they don't need it. I don't know. I haven't really given it a ton of thought, but I think it's a really interesting idea. And, Gino's been around the women's game for all of his adult life, and I think he has a pretty good feel for it. So I think it's something that I think the NCAA should take seriously and take a look at and study and see if it's the right way. I tend to think that the rules throughout basketball should be standardized, and I wouldn't mind at all seeing college go to a 24-second clock. I think it would help the game, and I think high school should go to a shot clock as well. They don't, most high school federations don't have a shot clock at all, and I think that's the way the game has gone. And I don't. I think two things need a shot clock. Basketball needs a shot clock, and golf needs a shot clock. But I think it would be great to have a 24-second shot clock in both games.
Yeah, I think my conversations with women also need a shot clock, so we can add that. We can add that to the tally. Hey, listen, always seriously a pleasure to have you on, and we'll get more hoops talk about the teams as the season goes on. I'll try and run you down sometime, maybe shortly before Christmas, after after all your trips are done. Are you by the way, are you preparing your body for you know, these trips and socializing with Raftery as the season draws near? I mean, are you really in training right now for that?
Yeah, I've already got my liver transplant scheduled for the future. But and, you know, any time you can be around Bill Raftery and Sean McDonough and they pay you for it, that's a pretty good gig. So I'm really looking forward to it. The first time we'll work together will be in Maui, which is always tough duty. Yeah. But it'll be a blast. You know, I love those guys. So being around them is a real treat.
Yeah, no sympathy for you on that end. Listen, Jay, thank you so much. If you are listening and you're one of the, I don't know, seven people that still don't follow Jay on Twitter, you can at Jay Billis, just as it sounds. Thanks again for coming on, and we'll talk to you again on Monday.